Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to On the Dean's List, a podcast that celebrates the art of conversation with your host, Dean Latticer.
Thank you, George. Good morning, everyone. You are on the Dean's List. I'm your host, Dean Latticer. We're on the Dean's List, celebrating the art of conversation. And a little insider information on this. This is a show that I've had several years in the making. As a creative, as a writer, I've always wondered what my legal responsibilities and rights are around creation of intellectual property. So a few weeks ago, we had on Lori T. Williams and her talking about her great business, Your Legal Resource. Well, I told her about this, and she brought our guest to my attention, and I am just really now looking forward to this because in the pre-call, he just proven what a leader and what a really great guy he is. Avery Goldstein is our guest. He is a partner in the firm Blue Filament Law, which specializes in intellectual property, including trademarks, copyrights, domain names, brand protection, brand management and enforcement, risk assessment, trial and trademark and appeal board proceedings, dispute resolutions. And so I want him on. We're going to talk about the basic information we all need to know, but we're also, I'm going to throw a few scenarios at him and ask him what we should do and talk about what we need to do, should we think we need to pursue a claim, and just, he's just a great guy, and he's kind of worked his way through the trenches to bring us his wisdom and expertise. So let's give a warm On the Dean's List welcome to Avery Goldstein. Avery, thanks for joining us.
Dean, pleasure. Yeah, I'm really excited to be here and happy to sort of walk you through the aspects of intellectual property and really play on sort of my background because I've been on both sides of the call. I've been involved with startup companies, worked as a researcher in industry, and hopefully that'll come to bear in our conversation today.
I think it will, and that was one of the things in reviewing your CV and looking at all your stuff, you really have the capability to walk your talk. Let's set the tone here. As creative, restless people, whether it's in our industry or whether it's in our personal life, we have that moment of enlightenment where an idea, a process, an inspiration comes to us, and then suddenly we see the whole world differently because of this inspiration. So once we get that idea worked out, teach us. What should we do with this vision? Bring us back down to earth a little bit, Avery.
Yeah, well, I mean, you don't necessarily want to come back down to earth, but you want to go into it with your eyes wide open. So the first sort of reality check, I think, really involves, what are the next steps? Is it something you're willing to, commit the energy and the resources to? Because, I often caution people that, protecting their intellectual property is actually the fun and easy part. It's, building a business around that really takes an enormous amount of time, largely because it's not in your control. At some point, you have to co-opt other people and really have them share your vision, whether they are, customers, suppliers, partners. And that takes a lot of effort because, everybody is bombarded with opportunities. So choosing your vision, there's an element of salesmanship to that. So usually, I think the very first thing is say, am I prepared to act on this? Because, we all hear all too often, when somebody sees a product in the market, well, I had that idea 20 years ago or, 5 years ago, whatever the amount of time is. And the difference is the person who actually brought that product to market, spent a lot of time and effort doing it. And I often say this to people, only half jokingly, if you work hard, for 10 years on your creation, you can be an overnight success. And there's plenty of media reports of somebody who has an idea, they start a successful business, and they become multimillionaires. The Horatio Alger of creativity. And what those stories always leave out is, you know, how many late nights were spent working on this, how many phone calls, how many dead ends, how much, you know, money, time was devoted to it. That really doesn't appear in those sort of characterizations.
No, it doesn't. And I think that sweat equity is so important, but I think that's where a lot of our, we get that emotional equity, that sweat equity into our great idea, and we want to see it pay dividends, both financially and in terms of our fulfillment. And you brought a great point. You can watch an episode of a show like Shark Tank or Dragon's Den because of the CBC here in Detroit, and you see a lot of people passionate about their ideas, creative about some stuff, and yet sometimes it just doesn't seem like they know where to turn or what they should be doing to protect themselves. Why don't you take us through some of the basic terms, help us in our brain to benchmark what's a patent, what's a trademark, a copyright, or other designations that we should be aware of?
Sure. And, so there's a number of different categories, and there's a little bit of overlap, but sort of broad general categories. Patents have sort of two subsets. There's utility patents, which cover products that are new and useful, and that would be either a new device, it could be a new process for manufacturing or doing something, could potentially be a business method, but at the end of the day, you're doing something useful. There's another type of patent called a design patent, which is really sort of an interesting kind of bridge, and that protects the artistic expression of a useful item. So it would be protecting the appearance of, you know, for example, like a coffee cup, and it works just like every other coffee cup. You know, it's a hollow cylinder with a handle, but it may have a different appearance. So it's really protecting the artistry in industrial design. There's trademarks, which protect your brand identity. And, I always sort of like the mental imagery of branding horses, you know, or cattle.
Okay.
So this is your identifier. When people hear that name, they associate that with your business as a provider of those goods and services. And that name is really kind of, you know, where all your goodwill is built up through advertising and positive customer experiences. Then you also have copyrights. And copyrights, I think we're all kind of familiar with those in the realm of if you come up with a new artistic work, whether it's a painting, a sculpture, a song, and that's the way of recording and providing an extra level of protection for that purely artistic effort. Another category, which is a little bit fuzzy, is trade secrets. And the one everybody sort of always has in the back of their mind is, you know, the mythical Coca-Cola formulation that, you know, I think the common mythology is there's some safe, you know, tucked away, you know, deep in the Coca-Cola world headquarters that has the magic formula in there. And, and you can keep things indefinitely as a trade secret. So, you know, generally those are the four categories. And, you know, again, in some places there's a little bit of overlap and options for doing more than one. But generally things fall into those categories. And I think it's also important to note, I guess there's a fifth category, which is none of the above. You just simply, you know, you never really need intellectual property protection unless you want to retain some kind of monopoly. You know, so for example, you develop a cure for cancer and you just simply want to donate it to the public. It's free for all to use. You may decide not to get intellectual property protection, but, you know, what history has shown us is without that intellectual property protection, nobody is going to want to actually distribute, you know, something as miraculous as a cure for cancer. because they just won't be able to cover their costs. So the paradox is sometimes that you actually have to protect something before you can give it away.
That's an interesting angle. Let's just kind of touch on that briefly, because I think that ability, you have to understand, maybe does protecting it congeal it and say, okay, this is this process or this is this technique, and I've taken that moment to congeal it, to codify it, to make sure that you understand. I'm not sitting there going to sit there and, it's not a trade secret, or I'm not going to sit there and get upset if other people use it. But does that kind of give people that intellectual and legal good housekeeping seal to go forward?
It really does. And, for example, like branding, the area of like trademarks, rigorously your rights come from actually being out there using it. But you get extra legal protections by actually going through the registration process. And similarly with copyrights, your copyright actually attaches the first time you publish the work. You play the song, you publish the book. There are copyright protections associated with that, but they get legally much stronger by going through the registration process.
Let's go there for a second, because
okay.
I mentioned that I have a brief audio clip of my daughter, and friends know that my daughter, Laura Jean, she's, sang at the local places like Crowfoot and Emerald Ballroom, AJ's when he had his place down in Ferndale and plus like that. What I want to do is play a brief clip and come back and talk about that side of the business, because, again, that seems to be the place where people, songwriters think that they're sea lawyers and they know everything when they're out at sea, but when they come back to land, they know nothing. Let me hit this quick clip here.
I just want to stay in bed with the covers over my head. Sleep hasn't done anything this week. I just want to hide, no one has to see. I wish I could drive a car, then I could get so far away from here and you, all the things you say you'll do. Because I'm just too much, but somehow not enough. Does that even make sense? Because I'm just a lie that no one sees is true.
All right. That's my kid, and the reason I play that is even her and I have had debates over the years. There's that old line, I should write out the lyrics, mail it to myself, never open the envelope, because then it's recognized by the U.S. Post Office, and that's a branch of the government. And I hear you chortling and chuckling at this notion. Okay, help me to school this kid, because I know she's listening. Tell my musician daughter what her daddy doesn't know.
Well, I heard that that same sort of myth growing up, that you could document a date of creation by mailing yourself an envelope. And the place where that really falls apart is, what's stopping you from sending yourself an empty, unsealed envelope, getting the postmark, and sealing it after the fact?
Mm-hmm.
So, and that basically is, falls in that urban myth sort of category of legal protections.
If she was going to write songs and she's going to do things for creatively, what makes sense for her to do without saying putting blue film at law on retainer for her to protect her stuff?
Well, I mean, very simply, just put a copyright notice the year that it was developed and published. Put a copyright notice on the song lyrics, for example, as they're being handed out. Another thing is actually, get a notary or someone to witness, those materials. Another feature, which is pretty simple, but simply ask a potential collaborator, supplier, whatever the context is, to sign a non-disclosure agreement. In other words, I'm providing you these song lyrics, not for you to go off and do with what you please, but simply for you to decide if you want to pursue a business relationship in terms of recording them or what have you. And if you're not going to do that, then you have to give them back. And by the way, we now have a legal contract that I can enforce against you if you abuse sort of the rights and responsibilities. So those are real simple things, and they don't even involve filing copyrights, which are also not a bad idea. That would be the other recommendation. Copyrights, again, protections attach as soon as you publish it, but those added protections come from simply going to the U.S. Copyright Office webpage, which has a fairly good set of instructions to walk you through the process of registering your creation. And people can certainly do that as well. The cost of registration is pretty modest. The place it gets somewhat tricky is if it's either done as a work for hire. In other words, you're paying somebody to develop something for you, and there's some form of assignment involved. That's when it gets a little dicey. But just in the context of a singer-songwriter, I would encourage them to simply bundle up their songs and file them periodically as a copyright. They'll get a registration number. And rather than doing that for each individual song, bundle them up as sort of a cost-saving measure and do it on a quarterly or yearly basis, whatever makes sense for them.
Like doing it as she usually puts them out hard on a disc as an EP. So take the four or five songs on that EP, bundle them, and then say, okay, Transition Boulevard or Lyrics in the Notebook, which were the names of the two things she sold. That's that compilation, and so all the original works on there are covered under this copyright. Am I tracking with you correctly?
That's right. And that just really provides additional legal protections if you ever go to enforce that, as compared to the basic protections of just simply having created it. So one of the great examples they give you in law school when you talk about copyrights is once you write out your grocery shopping list, as soon as somebody else sees that, you have copyright protection in it. Unless you're particularly vain, really nobody else wants your grocery shopping list, but nonetheless, you have put some creative effort into that, and you have ownership interest in it.
I don't think a bunch of crazy cat ladies are going to want to know what brand of cat foods I want. But I think we could go just on this, and I want to make sure we kind of are broad based here. A couple other examples I want to give you from real life here. That same daughter just bought a house over in Madison Heights, in a great place. And we had our exterminator out, and I've known Ted probably 15 years. And he's got this proprietary mixture of chemicals, which he uses in his business. And I know being a chemist, this is going to be in your sweet spot. Now, these are highly effective, and they're very environmentally friendly, Avery. But should he place and pay some sort of protections with this compound, if he's using it to spray, or if he, he's buying them from a supplier and he's putting them together, and what should he do with that? Because we were talking about that in advance of the show, and he said, ask the lawyer, see what he thinks I should do.
First I'll give you the legal answer, the Weasley legal answer, which is it depends, and then I'll explain it. So, and it depends on the following. If he wants to basically run a service business and have a competitive advantage compared to other people in the area, the answer is maybe you just keep it as a trade secret what that proprietary blend is. If, on the other hand, he says, this has potentially implications beyond my individual service business, that I may want to license this formulation to major manufacturers, and they can in turn sell it elsewhere. That's when you start looking at the possibility of doing some form of patent filing. And by the way, the fact that all the compounds, he's purchasing them elsewhere, doesn't negate patentability. you know, his inventive concept is really finding, you know, which of the many different available materials to use and the amounts of those. And it sounds like he's getting, you know, sort of a surprising result out of those. In other words, you know, more than you would expect from just the combination of, you know, of two or more compounds. So the first thing I usually recommend is, you know, before you sort of take that step, because he's not in the chemical manufacturing business, I usually recommend people do at least an executive summary of a business plan. And that's typically, you know, 2 pages long or so. And I usually tell people that, you know, that's going to take them somewhere around 40 to 60 hours to do, which, you know, generally I get a lot of skepticism in response to that. But it's not the writing that takes the time. It's getting the information to answer the fundamental questions of how much is it going to cost to manufacture? How much can we sell it for? How big is the market? Who are the likely buyers? Am I going to set up manufacturing facilities myself, or am I going to license this? And, you know, the answer is you cannot go into a meeting, you know, whether you're talking to a potential licensee or, you know, or customer, and when they ask you one of those questions, say, I don't know. That's, you know, that's a fatal failure. So after, you know, he would go about, you know, working up at least an executive summary of a business plan, which, you know, has nothing to do with the intellectual property. That's just getting a sense of, is this an idea worth putting resources behind? And assuming that comes up positive, then the next step is typically doing what's called a prior art search. In other words, patentability requires that you be the very first person, you know, in the history of mankind to have come up with this, you know, particular combination. And the reason for that is the bargain you're striking with a patent is the government is going to give you a 20-year monopoly, limited-term monopoly, and in exchange, you tell the world how to make and use the invention. Okay. And that's a pretty stiff bargain because, you know, that goes exactly opposite to trade secret. So to get a patent, you're going to have to share with the world, you know, what exactly these materials are. But in exchange for that, you can prevent anybody else from making, using, or selling, or importing that particular combination. And then once you have those rights, you can basically give somebody a license that says you, in particular, now have the right to do it because you're in one way or another compensating me, or, you know, I just like you, whatever your motivation is for doing that. So that prior art search is, typically, you know, somebody who works in the field has some sense of it, but generally we go to outside resources. The internet's a great place to look. The European Patent Office has excellent resources. And also in Detroit, we have access to, you know, some really good search facilities down at the satellite office of the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, as well as the Detroit Public Library has some devoted librarians who will help people who are unfamiliar with the process of going about searching to evaluate whether their invention is in fact novel and merits patent protection.
I think you're touching on something also that's cool, indicative to southeastern Michigan, is because there's such a climate for this because of the Detroit 3 and all the subsidiaries and such. Prior to getting into your legal career, you worked as an industrial scientist. You worked with Dow. And that's a whole – we could spend a couple of hours just skimming the surface on that, but that's a big climate here. You mentioned, again, if I create something, say I'm employed for a company or if I think of an innovative way to do it, I mean, tell us a little bit about being on that end of it. You know, if I'm working for a company, what do I need to think or what do I need to do? Because a lot of intellectuals, you know, that's really big way to get up the Detroit 3 is to create something or patent something.
Yeah. Dean, you bring up a really good point is, a lot of times, people think of, Silicon Valley as as a technology hub in some other places. But, one of the reasons that Detroit was picked as the first place outside of Washington, D.C. for a branch patent office was because of the extraordinary number of patent filings coming out of this area. And it's it doesn't really promote itself, but the the concentration of of engineers and technology and Metro Detroit and Michigan as a whole is is really pretty astounding. And there's because of that, there's an enormous infrastructure because of the manufacturing tradition here of things that I think most people would be surprised at is there's pretty much a vendor or company that can do anything under the sun in a nondescript building that you've probably driven by dozens of times. Being a sort of a professional inventor working in sort of a large company format, it really varies as to how much companies reward patents. Some companies, will even give you a percentage of the value they see coming out of that intellectual property. And some give you a dollar or a pat on the back. But even if there's it just happens. But even when there's not a monetary return, a lot of times that becomes a pretty serious factor in somebody securing a promotion, because what at the end of the day they're doing is they're bringing potentially extraordinary value to the company. Right now we're in a era where there's ever-changing environmental regulations, safety improvements, and for companies that innovate, those become enormous opportunities to put business into play that was otherwise locked up with a given supplier. On the other hand, companies that are not willing to innovate and are just comfortable moving along, selling the same product they've sold for years, those changes are catastrophic.
You look at a company like IBM, where innovation, or not IBM, 3M, innovation is just so important. I know in my MBA we use them as a case study time and time again for innovation.
Yeah, and there's companies who have very different business models, and some companies really don't have much of a culture as to how to go from a concept to bringing out production. And that even includes the way for example the sales force is compensated. Because it's a lot more work to sell a new product than continue servicing an existing product. So, a company really has to sort of look at all those things to make sure that the metrics they're giving are going to give them the outcomes they want. But for somebody in a company environment, sometimes it's an uphill battle initially to fight for your idea and innovate, very similar to it is with any other sort of startup. But generally, there's similar kind of rewards in terms of promotions. So I think I
want to make sure we touch on at least one more topic in the time we have remaining here, and that's enforcement. Whether we've just put it down as a business plan, we've gone through procedurally, there are people who can demonstrate or feel they've been wronged. It's not sitting there just clicking past Home Shopping and QVC and saying, "Oh, I thought of that." If somebody thinks they've been legitimately wronged, Avery, help us to understand what the remedy is that we should seek. Should we quickly dial you up, or should we do some investigating work on our own, or what should somebody do if they feel that they've been wronged?
Yeah, I think the first thing is really get some factual information together, because at some point you're going to have to prove it one way or another, and to the extent that you can get information, it's I mean, it's necessary. It's a prelude to anything else you're going to do. The other thing is, rather than going off into immediate litigation where the only people who ultimately prevail are the attorneys, I really think most of the time there's some other way to resolve it, without going that route. So I would really encourage people to, especially if it's somebody they know, to reach out and let them know that there's a problem here and see what makes sense. And as part of that, really kind of create sort of a two-tiered list of this is what I really need to have happen with them, and this is what I would like to have happen. And if your demands are basically that somebody, completely go out of business and stop earning a living, that's going to be a very difficult situation to resolve through negotiations because there's really no middle ground. But creating sort of what you want versus what you need from a settlement, tends to be very helpful in finding, something that works for everybody. The majority
Well, don't go for nuclear annihilation here instead. Just try to find as much, shall we say, a happy medium or a balance on it as possible.
Right. And the nuclear option will almost by definition require litigation and costs associated with it. And that certainly has its place. But, recognize what's in your best business interest and also I think remove the emotional component of it is, look for, what's ultimately best for your business and not necessarily what feels good.
In the time remaining, kind of sum up a little bit of what we've just briefly touched on stuff here, and I wish we had a lot more time, but help us to think about it. Again, innovation is important. Protecting our mental and emotional and financial investments is important. But as somebody who sees this and reads on other case law examples and stuff like that, is there any rule of thumb or any sort of ideas that you want to leave us with when we're putting together our ideas, when we're innovating or when we're creating? Kind of give us something to hang our hat on, if you will.
Yeah, I think it's one of the fundamental issues is I think really have a dispassionate vision. One thing that makes a lot of sense is if the idea doesn't have, it ultimately doesn't prove out for whatever reason, don't be afraid to walk away and embrace a new idea instead of carrying on with something that, is not going anywhere. And history is full of examples of, serial entrepreneurs who have tried things and you learn from failing and take those lessons and apply them to the next thing because it's really it's a mindset and a process of how you go from innovation to developing a business. And I think another thing is also doing that documentation to get ready for the next step, which is whatever your product ultimately is, how are you going to move it from a concept out to store shelves where you can actually see a return on it?
Oh, preach that. You're talking to a writer here, Avery. Preach that. I mean, a lot of people, they won't even write out that grocery list. So having them take the time to at least embrace their idea and talk about the boundaries of it and such. I mean, you've made my day with that one here. So I appreciate you bringing that to the table.
Sure, and it's also a good indicator if you don't have time to, basically fill out your laundry list. What's the likelihood that you're going to have the hundreds of hours it's going to need to go from a startup to a cash positive business? And that's okay because I think a lot of times the personality of creativity is different than the personality of marketing and business development. And if you recognize that in yourself, and I have to confess, I'm one of those people as well, then the answer is you find a partner who's not a carbon copy of you, but brings that complementary skill set so that you can really take off and, you know, share your expertise where it makes the most sense and really get something going.
Avery, your business, you have a great partner there. They're at Blue Filament Law. Touch on her briefly and also help us to get in touch with you should we require a little bit of expertise or a consultation on something. I think you've done some great preventative stuff to get people to think beyond their thinking, but if there should come and, you know, we come up with this dynamic manufacturing process or we want to take something to market, there still is, I think there's always going to be a call for great services like yourself. Talk about your firm, talk about the ways to get in touch with you.
Sure. And my partner is Mary Margaret O'Donnell, and her expertise is trademark filings and brand management, enforcement as well. And, you know, what's nice is, you know, to try to compartmentalize those things, have, you know, very much a brand focus when you're doing branding. We can be reached at www.bluefilamentlaw.com, and that's blue as in the color, filament as in light bulbs, and L-E-W for law. And we service actually most of our clients are nationwide and overseas, so it's actually somewhat of a pleasant surprise when we actually get to put a face to a voice or an email address.
And I will definitely be taking up your offer to get together and enjoy a cup of Joe. You're in Birmingham, and I'm just up here in Rochester Hills. So that's I have reasons to get down quite frequently, and as circumstance allows, I would also welcome the chance to put the faces and names and URLs together on stuff like that. Boy, we could go for another 2-3 hours on this, Avery, and I do appreciate your expertise and you bring your wisdom to bear on the subject.
That was my pleasure. And happy to follow up.
Go ahead. There's only one thing that I have left to say, and that's Avery Goldstein, you are on the Dean's List. And that's where we're going to leave it today. And I know we went a little long, but I think that the things Avery had to say were so important for us to hear. Because as creatives, as business professionals, I think he's got a great approach to it that we can resolve some of these issues just by documenting and having that clarity of our ideas here. So thanks to Avery for joining us this morning. I'm Dean Latticer. This has been On the Dean's List, the podcast that celebrates the art of conversation. If you're a first-time listener or a long-time listener, we invite you back. We've got a great guest coming up next week. Lynn Cadence will talk about social media and marketing. In 2 weeks, John Wesley Brown, the oldest son of Les Brown, the motivator, will be on the show talking about carrying his father's legacy and also giving us some powerful strategies and tools to move our lives forward. And then Jim McFarlane, former Detroit news media writer, get my Detroit favorite straight. Now he does a lot of writing for the Metro Times. He's going to be on. So until next time, it's been this time. Thanks for listening in. Thank you.